Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. I want to talk to you about the Bose S1, which is an amazing speaker for acoustic guitar gigs that I recently got to test drive. The S1 has two separate channels. It's got one for guitar and one for microphone, and there's a third channel you can use for a looper or for backing tracks that you can access by Bluetooth or through a 1/8 inch input. And the S1 is actually portable and rechargeable for up to 11 hours. So the guitar and mic channels, they have separate independent tone, volume, and reverb controls, and they also have something called a proprietary tone match switch, which EQs, optimizes, and restores the natural sound of your acoustic guitar, which, as you know, is typically your biggest problem when you're playing acoustic amps. I tested the S1 speaker, and it's very responsive to pickups, and the tone, volume, and reverb controls genuinely work great. You can position the S1 four different ways. You can tilt it back to broadcast out to an audience, or you can put it horizontally, vertically, or on a stand. The S1 also has a proprietary Bose accelerometer, which automatically adjusts the EQ and optimizes the sound based on whichever one of these four positions you're using. So effectively, you have an acoustic guitar amp, a PA, and a killer Bluetooth speaker all in one. So the bottom line is, if you're an acoustic player, there's absolutely nothing out there that sounds this good and this big, that's portable and battery powered. And the S1 also happens to be the best Bluetooth speaker Bose makes, which says a lot. I used it myself for a party we had here one night, and it was absolutely amazing. All my kids were freaking out. It's like having a full stereo system out on your patio. You can easily use this for DJing, tailgating, or whatever you want. Before this, you'd have to spend thousands of dollars on a bunch of equipment to get the same thing the S1 does. On top of that, it's sleek and it looks great, just like all Bose devices do. And besides whatever money back guarantee you get from wherever you buy the S1, Bose also warranties the S1 for 2 years from any kind of defects in materials or performance. For more information and to find out where to get your own S1, I'd like you to go to pro.bose.com/podcast. Check it out at pro.bose.com/podcast and get the S1. It's outstanding. This is an important announcement for anyone thinking about advertising here on Everyone Loves Guitar. We've experienced incredible growth. We currently have over 82,000 monthly listens, and I would anticipate cracking six figures in the next few months. We've also grown our YouTube subscriber base by 72 times. During this time, we've kept our advertising rates consistent, but I wanted to let you know we'll be increasing these rates after the first of the new year. So if you're a business looking to generate new leads or increase your cash flow by adding new clients or customers, or if you're looking for general brand exposure, or if you're a label looking to promote new music and you want to lock into the current advertising rates before they go up at the end of this year, then listen closely. Fill in the short form at everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Even if you want to advertise next year, contact us now and you'll get to lock into the current rates before they go up at the end of this year. Thanks for listening. See you soon.
If you want to buy or sell a home or investment property and you're here in the Tampa Bay area in Hillsboro, Pinellas, or Pasco counties, then listen up. West Florida Real Estate is a local residential real estate broker that's helped over 250 Bay Area homeowners buy and sell their properties in the last 4 years alone. If you're looking to sell, you'll want to get their free report, The 7 Biggest Mistakes Homeowners Make When Hiring a Realtor. And if you're looking to buy a property, you definitely want to get your hands on The 21 Most Expensive Mistakes Tampa Home Buyers Make When Buying a Home. Each one of these reports is going to save you time and money. Inside, you'll discover the 7 most important things to consider when hiring a realtor, what to do if you're buying and selling a home at the same time, and the danger of choosing a realtor who agrees with everything you say. To get your hands on these free reports, head on over to westfloridarealestate.com. That's westfloridarealestate.com.
Hey, this is Craig. If you like this show and you want to support it and you want to keep it free, head on over to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/support.
Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. I've got a brilliant guitar player, but also a really nice guy, a sweet guy, and an extremely bright, well-read player. And I can't look at him right now because I'm going to laugh. We've been spending time talking and all
that's
hell's
the best. That's the best intro.
Break loose here.
That's so good.
I'm with the one and only Eugene Edwards. And he's come out of his massage room today just to do the interview. Let me tell you a little bit about Eugene. And first of all, I want to thank Brian Whalen, Cool Hair Live, for hooking us up.
Yes, thank you, Brian.
Eugene was born in the border town of Yuma, Arizona, and seriously got the music bug at age 7 after seeing his first concert. After a brief stint at Berkeley, he hit the road with country rock band Fast Gun, and he earned a California Country Music Association Award as Guitarist of the Year. Landing in L.A. by the summer of 96, he played in the rockabilly trio, Russell Scott and his Red Hots. You'd never see like a heavy metal band called Russell Scott and his Red Hots. That's such a country name, isn't it?
Very. It was an unusual group, but I loved it.
Russell Scott and his Red Hots for 3 years. He then struck out on his own. He formed the Eugene Edwards Band, releasing the album called My Favorite Revolution in 2004 to critical acclaim. All the while he performed with Sha Na Na, he held a regular gig at Disneyland, performed as Richie Valens, and he ended up an on-air talent with the Gary Bryan Morning Show on K-Earth 101. Hey, Eugene Edwards here.
Kind of, yeah.
While also working in film and TV, including a cameo in an early episode of Mad Men. I got to tell you, Eugene's a really good-looking guy. Great hair. I'm like, he got the call that changed everything after that. He this was in April 2012, and he got called to become Dwight Yoakam's guitar player. While touring year-round with Dwight, Eugene is also the co-host of the Jukebox Graduate Podcast, and we'll talk about that. That's a show about music and things that we learn from it. He's also performed at the Ryman, the Cavern Club, Red Rocks, the O2 in London, and everywhere in between. He's worked with the likes of Brian Wilson, Stevie Wonder, Sly Stone, which is awesome, Beck, Jacob Dylan, The Monkees, Post Malone, and others. That's the first time in history, maybe, that all those names have come up in the same sentence.
We're gunning for that.
Yeah, man. Post Malone, the Monkees. Beck, Sly Stone, and Steve. Anyway, man, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you coming on. Thanks for being a good sport about everything.
Well, I like the part about my looks.
There you go,
I think,
man.
We should just end this here because this has gone very, very well for me.
Well, let me tell you, no one's ever going to say that about me. Like, I know I got a face for radio, bro. So, and I'm good with that. I'm good with it. But you know, hey, what's nothing wrong with being a good looking dude. So, man, it sounds like you started at Berkeley, but then you left to go out to California. I was just curious what happened.
Yeah, not even California. You know, growing up in Yuma was a very unique thing. And of course this is, I hate it when people say these caveats, but it bears noting that
is this an asterisk? Is this the word asterisk?
No, it was before the internet. This was, okay. In fact, cable TV didn't get to us till the early 80s. There's just not a lot of information coming through Yuma, Arizona in the 70s. When I was growing up, when I was a little kid.
So it's like a very, like a small, just a really small town or village?
It was much smaller then. It's an interesting place because it's a tri-legged economy. There's the agriculture, which is seasonal. The Marine Corps has its largest air base there.
Oh, I had no
so
idea.
You would have people from all over the world living there temporarily. And then in the wintertime, retired folks from colder climates flock down there. We call them snowbirds.
Yeah.
And so, like, the population will double for a matter of months, right? Like, it's just this huge. And leading up to that, though, you know, I just somehow just early on knew that I couldn't stay. I couldn't stay. I had to go somewhere bigger. I had to get to a city. And And I knew I was going to be a musician, in, you know, one way or another. So I applied to Berkeley, and was accepted. I had a buddy who also applied and was accepted.
Out of Yuma.
Out of Yuma, okay. Yeah. So we drove we packed up a U-Haul and we drove ourselves there. That's cool, man. And I'd never been east of Tucson in my life at the point, at this point, right? So, so it was great. We got there, but frankly, you know, how I was going to afford, how my family and I were going to afford Berkeley for a few years had not really been figured out.
Yeah.
And then after a semester, some issues did happen back home, and only because they affect other people who aren't here to tell their side of the story.
I'll
kind of skip the drama of that.
Totally cool.
But it was clear that I couldn't stay. And so I had been in that band Fast Gun that you mentioned, which was based in Yuma. I had played guitar for them the summer leading up to my leaving for Berkeley, and they had not replaced me yet. So I just had to come back to Yuma, and now I don't know what I'm going to do. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just go to the local community college here, or maybe I'll go to Northern Arizona. I'll you know, still kind of thinking I'd have to go to school.
But were you bummed? Were you bummed? Because I mean, you were dying to get out.
Yeah, I was devastated. Bummed doesn't even cover it, man.
I figured.
But thankfully they said, well, if you want to just to, you know, till you figure out what you want to do, you can play with us, which was great because, I mean, this is kind of the basic economics of being like an 18-year-old who already had some student debt. Was this band, we had this house gig at this club in Yuma, and we would play six nights a week, five sets a night. Right?
Holy crap.
So we talked about those Gladwellian 10,000 hours. It was exactly what I needed. Now here's the funny thing though. When I got to Berkeley, you know, meeting other players was great. There were people from around the world. You know, I hadn't really met a lot of people from Europe before. I don't think I'd ever met someone who grew up in Japan. Like it was wonderful. Right. But they were all shocked that I had left a paying gig to go there. There was like,
oh, they would have different frame of reference. Different.
What are you doing here? You got paid how much?
Yeah.
To play? Like you gigged? What's it like? You know. And
yeah. But so they didn't have the pain of like. But it's in Yuma in the back of their mind, like you did. You know.
Yeah. Well, there's that. Yeah, and I just thought, well, and here's the other thing, I was not that into jazz. I mean, I liked it a lot and I respected it and I could pull it off, but I hadn't really seriously studied jazz up until that point. And I was really, at that point, my heart was really in pop songwriting, like bands like Squeeze and Elvis Costello, Nick Lowe. I was really getting into that stuff. Like, how does this stuff work? And I don't think Berkeley did their songwriting program really didn't fit that thing at the time. So I just wasn't really a proper fit anyway.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I had gone back, I took the paying gig and I actually immediately paid off the little student loan I had, which was a great feeling, like just gone. And then the band started to hit the road, which they hadn't really been traveling, that band Fasca. So then that was good. You know, we had two full-size pickups and a trailer, and you were still playing. This is in the early 90s. You're playing country music bars that have a big dance floor. Line dancing's happening. You've got to play a lot of covers. We would sprinkle in some originals.
Were you writing some of these originals?
I wasn't writing yet at the time, not at all. A guy, Don, was the lead singer. He was the songwriter. And by the way, I'm a child, right? I mean, like everyone else is in the band is in their late 20s, early 30s. I'm this 18-year-old. In fact,
so it was a great experience for you musically and socially.
Well, it's funny you mentioned socially because many places, depending on what state, especially depending on what the alcohol laws were, you know, we play a set and we take a break. And a lot of places, I wasn't allowed to leave the stage.
Oh, because of the alcohol. Break. Yeah.
Because I'm under 21.
Yeah.
So I bring books and I would just sit on the lip of the stage and read a book. And like, how awkward is this?
Yeah, man. You look like the lonely kid. Nobody wants to hang out with or something. It's like, oh my God.
Like, and it's like, yeah, this is, but you know, what? It was just the reality. And then we were, so we would zigzag and play all these places but it was great.
Let me interrupt you just one second. Intellectually, you're a very smart guy. Did you
how did you weigh out, like, you're super passionate about music, obviously, but you're, you're like a rare, you got left and right brain going for you. That's not a common thing for any people. I mean, you're either predominantly one over the other, but you, I mean, my perception, you're very well read. You're very bright. How did you, were you able to quench that thirst while still, you know, your passion was quenched playing music? Would it, was that not an issue? You just, that was it. Music was your thing. That was a primary.
Music. I mean, I never considered when in college and becoming like an English major or history major or anything like that. I couldn't, that would, it never would have.
Like, you didn't want to be an accountant or anything like that. Or
no.
Like learn science or like bio or, you know, whatever the hell it is, or a doctor.
Not for the sake of a profession.
Okay.
I mean, I will read, you know, physics books and things out of a curiosity of the world and how it functions, but no, not as a life or as a profession.
Right.
But thank you for your compliment, by the way, that I've never, I don't think about my brain, I suppose. So that's probably why I never thought about was left or right brain.
Dude, that's what happens when you give me $20. No, you're clearly.
I was just to say I was handsome, but then you took it further and talked about my brain. It was kind of an isolated few years in a way, though, because it was really just, you know, like the five of us in that band. You pull into a town, you play for a few days. I didn't socialize with anybody in the audience, really. Everyone was older than me. I was a teetotaler. I wasn't really a fit other than I knew how to play guitar. So what happens is from there, and like I said, you know, I should go back a little bit. It's really important. I think it's underestimated. Like, I was born in 73. And so right around the time I'm 10 years old, MTV comes to town. Mm-hmm. And I was a latchkey kid at that point. And that was probably one of the best things that happened to me, because after school, I'd come home and you turn on TV and there'd be people that I'd never seen. Right. I mean, how am I going to ever come across someone who looks like Adam Ant?
Or, because it's in Yuma.
No one dresses like that. There's not I mean, there's not an alternative scene to anything, man. And I can tell you the moment, the first time I heard, I would say heard and saw, but I didn't see them, heard the Replacements was on MTV, and it was a video. It's for Bastards of Young, and the whole video is just, it's just a still of a stereo speaker playing the song. And a kid's like Chuck Taylor's.
Right.
Like, that's it. But so just having this different, a different source of information, and just there's like, say, there's a bigger world out there.
Okay.
Those sort of things were kind of like, okay, so I know there's a bigger world out there. And then, but then, you know, with Fast Gun, we didn't really, we would play out of the way little towns and stuff. I remember playing Albuquerque, this place called the Sundance Saloon, because I remember on Saturdays you had to play 7 sets.
That's crazy. I cannot believe how much tuition here.
You can repeat tunes that you played in the first 2 sets. You can repeat those later in the night because, you know, those people won't be here. I thought, thank you. You learn how to move gear, set up PA, play and tear it down and do it all over again. And those were valuable lessons. But then that band started to kind of fizzle out, and they were still based in Yuma. And I was like, I don't even want to be hubbing out of Yuma anymore. But we had played San Diego a lot by then. San Diego was only like a 3-hour drive from Yuma due west.
Okay.
So I had fallen in with the rockabilly scene there.
Okay, sure.
I had gone out to see a band, actually a friend of mine who's an older cat, and he used to manage a lot of clubs, and he says, I'll get you in, because I still was underage.
Like the Blasters, that kind of stuff? Underground?
Well, actually, Blasters were quite famous compared to, it was a band called Hot Rod Lincoln. It was a 3-piece rockabilly band, very, very, very much based on like the Stray Cats. And for all I know, maybe you've already had Buzz on your show.
No,
if not,
I know that
if band. Not, you, if not, you will. I was snuck into this club here's the other thing. I never got to see live music because I'm underage. I can't get into bars. And then sometimes if there was,
and you're playing 6 or 7 nights a week. So anybody's in town, you got no breaks.
Yeah. So I'd get tickets to see Los Lobos if they were playing on a Monday night somewhere that I could get to, but it had to be, it had to be a concert, but I couldn't. So anyway, someone snuck me into the club. I saw this band. It was just, I just saw them through the window. This guy's playing a Gretsch 6120. I said, I want to see that band. And then I became friendly with them, and they turned me on to these other bands in that scene, bands in San Diego, a lot of bands out of LA. And I heard and eventually met Russell Scott, who's this really, really unforgettable character. This 6'3" guy, mountain of a dude. He wears overalls. He plays upright bass. He has this high, beautiful voice, though, and he sings like an angel. And I'd actually heard of him on a bootleg cassette, a 4-song cassette that was being traded around. I learned every song on it. And then I finally met him in person and sat in with him.
Oh, that's really cool.
And played his tunes. And so, but this is before cell phones. And at one point he needed a guitar player. He remembered me, but he had no idea how to get a hold of me, And a mutual friend bumped into me somewhere and said, oh, Russell's trying to find you. He needs a guitar player. And then I thought, how do I find him? And so eventually in 96, I moved here to LA to play with Russell. And that's what
brought me to Los Angeles. So you've been in LA, with a math,
23 years.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Very cool. So there were no, there was
the
no,
longest I've ever lived anywhere.
There was no alt scene in the bingo halls in Yuma when the Snowbirds came.
No, no, there was just nothing. I mean, there were a few punk bands every now and then, but there wasn't really That's enough amazing. Of a conversation going on there. So it was a frustrating place for someone like me, whatever that means. It was a frustrating place for someone like me to be in, because you couldn't even hop online and see. You have your niche thing and find out. It was like, Seth Meyers has the joke that he went to college in the mid 90s and he says it was the worst time. It's post AIDS, pre internet. And just think post of that, AIDS, pre internet. Pocket. Yeah. Man. Yeah. So, and having said, so I missed out on, so it was, I was moved out here to LA and just fell in with a lot of fun people.
Is that okay? So how did you get the Country Music Association, California CMA Guitarist of the Year?
Yeah. The California chapter, that was with Fast Gun. Actually, we were, I don't know how it happened. Honestly, it just, I was kind of in the dark about some of those things, and someone just said, oh, you've been nominated for this. And I thought, oh, that's nice. But I had no idea. I was like, who votes? How do they gauge that? Cause, and then, when we went to the award show and I won.
Good for you, man.
Thank you. It was a boost. It was a nice boost to my ego at the time, because I don't really know a lot of other guitar players, because you're not, if you're playing a club, you're the only band there for the week.
Okay.
You never see another band because you're all revolving around. So, but yeah, I think it was a little bit like, okay, no, you can do this, I mean, I was going to do it anyway, but it was kind of nice that some sort of like board of some sort or some.
Man, it's always good to get recognized for something, for anything. Okay. So did that help you? Did that now launch you and like give you the exposure and get you some other gigs?
No, that was the thing. That band was very, very closed. First we worked all the time. So there really was no time to be in another band or start or have a side band or be a hired gun for some other band.
But the CMA, the California CMA didn't even like, you didn't have someone, hey, I heard you got this award. I'd like to check you out and be.
No.
Oh my God.
No, honestly. Or if it did, I didn't know about it.
Yeah.
No, that's never even occurred to me that it would become something else. And I don't, frankly, I didn't have the gumption to just pick up and leave and say, I'm out of this situation and I'm going to try and get something bigger. I wasn't that secure.
It's tough, man. It's tough when you're that young too. And you know what else is tough?
at least from my perspective, I think, when you don't have like a mentor or somebody to help push you along with some aspect of life, mm-hmm. how the hell are you supposed to know? I mean, it's literally, yeah. I mean, unless you, well, then, serendipity happens and you meet a person that says, opens the thought process to you and gives you a little pat on the back, you know, you just don't know.
Yeah. And also, so I probably would have been suspicious of somebody from the outside saying, hey, you know, you should be on your own. You don't need to be in this situation. I was so loyal to that situation because, right. you know, don't forget, man, it saved me. I mean, I was, you know, I thought Boston, that thing was going to be a home for a while. And then it suddenly, no, that's not the case. Okay. So where am I supposed to be now? And then these folks took me in and, you know, they had to, maybe have taken this 18-year-old onto their hands.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, me being successful would mean that the band would be successful. I never thought those two things would be separated. So it did take for the band itself to kind of run its course. Don, the leader of the band, he jokes about it now. He says like, oh yeah, you were just like the second I was ready to have the talk with everybody. You know, hey, I think it's run its course. It's like, where'd Gene go? Like you were already gone. Like, you know, so
you must have been ready at that point. If somebody must have put something,
I was. Well, yeah, because I had been hanging out with the Hot Rod Lincoln guys.
Okay.
And finally I was hanging out with people a little closer to my age. It didn't belong to Yuma. It didn't belong to the Fast Gun situation. This was something that I could call my own in some way. And that is what happened. I instead of spending days off in Yuma, I spent days off in San Diego hanging out with those folks and have friends that are, you know, people that are friends to this day.
That's really cool.
You know, yeah. And there's really a few deep connections there. That was a transitional period at this point in probably 22, 23, something like that.
Do you know Tim Godwin?
That sounds familiar.
He's with Taylor now, but he was an artist back in the day around that same time. And I think he was in San Diego.
Probably. I remember Jewel at the time, actually. I remember she, you know, her record wasn't out yet. And I remember kind of going to like a coffee house one afternoon because they're having music. And I remember seeing her there. And then I remember the San Diego Music Awards. My band was up for something. And I remember being in the wings with her and I think it was her mom and she won Best New Artist or something like that. She was just so, I mean, she was shaking. It was so sweet. And I thought she was wonderful. She would do this yodeling at the end of her act. And I thought her songs were great. This guy, Steve Poltz, who was in a band called the Rugburns, fantastic band. He co-wrote some of her, it was a really funny band. They did this great version of the Sesame Street theme. He co-wrote some of the early hits for her. And I didn't know these people well, but I remember being very, very excited that just to stand around some of these folks, these people are really doing things, you know?
What prompted you at that point to say, I'm going to be a band leader? And then also, what did you learn from that experience?
Well, after a while, the Russell situation, in those 3 years, I grew a lot as a person and I learned a little more about what I wanted out of my life, I suppose. And so it was just time for me to go. Russell, I remember one night late, we were in Europe somewhere in a hotel room and we were talking and I remember, and I'd probably been with him for a year or so. And he said, you know, there's going to be a time when you're going to outgrow this group. And I said, nah, Russell, that, you know, he says, no, it is, it's going to happen. And he says, I want you to be able to come up and tell me that it's time.
Oh, that's cool.
He says, I want you to tell me that it's time. I will understand because it's natural. And he says, don't, you know, just bail or don't double cross me. It's not necessary. You're not, you know, just, I want you to come up and tell me. I'll be able to take it.
That was really supportive.
One day I realized, it's a beautiful thing to have said.
Yeah.
So I knew that when it was time to call him and say, yeah, I'm going to kind of do something else, that he would receive it well.
Great.
And he did. And he did. So then, and I did float around for a bit. There was another group, a couple guys that I thought were a little more organized and maybe were a little more ambitious. And I kind of had a group with them for a moment, but that didn't quite take off. And then now I was really just by myself and no band. And by the way, now I'm kind of starting to actually write songs. And that's really where this comes in. And I wasn't going to write rockabilly songs necessarily or swing tunes, you know, because we just come out. This was during the swing scare of the mid-90s.
The swing scare.
To paraphrase Martin Wall. But I was really interested in writing short, catchy rock songs. And I guess writing my own tunes was kind of the real impetus of all that. Hmm. So I kind of was floating around kind of open mic nights at cafes here in LA. And that was just an awful experience, really. It was really I didn't see what it was a real bad waste of time, in my opinion, the way those things are structured. I met some like-minded folks there, but I realized that my songs they needed to be more dynamic to cut across the way I heard them. So I kind of pulled together some friends I'd met along the way who I thought, you always said you're into this type of music. You know, you want to try and do these tunes, and so we very humbly started. Just trying to find a corner bar that would let us play songs that we wanted to play and wouldn't hassle us. And I knew that the pay to play scene in the clubs in LA wasn't going to work. Philosophically, we weren't a trendy outfit in any way. So it wasn't like we're going to attract some scene's attention just by proxy of being, whatever, you know, wearing the right clothes or being right. Or calling ourselves a certain genre. That was the hard thing. It was like, what kind of music is it? I was like, it's just kind of good rock tunes. I don't know what to say.
Was it like what they would call today Americana fall into that?
Maybe some of it, maybe. It fell into what was called power pop, which that was a scene. And we played these festivals a lot, International Pop Overthrow and all that. But what I learned from it was you have to believe in yourself more than anybody else on the planet, and you've got to be your best PR person at any given moment. You're not going to attract good management if they don't see that you have this just mad death energy to make it. And because management could be just anybody in terms of there's no school for how to do that. But it does have to be someone who believes in you even more than you believe in you.
Yeah.
And, being the band leader was not difficult in any way, but also I was probably a little too relaxed to become successful at doing it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
It was very, very kind of, I didn't tell anybody what to wear or what gear to use, or I didn't really, you know what I didn't do? I didn't curate.
Yeah.
What Eugene Edwards, you didn't as a product.
Yeah, it wasn't
was.
A deliberate. I understand. You presented yourself without deliberate intention.
That's
behind,
right.
Yeah.
We just Which showed is, up yeah. and played tunes.
Well, so that's a really good lesson that you learned, you know, how important that is.
Mm-hmm. How to brand yourself, how to market yourself, those things.
Which I'm sure working with Dwight has been like something, like a complete education.
Like, that's how you do that.
Yeah.
That's how you do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how did Dwight wind up connecting with you?
Well, you mentioned earlier Brian Whelan who hooked us up. So Brian, when I had the Eugene Edwards brand, Brian was in it for quite a while.
I'll say two guitar players.
Well, that's the thing about Brian. I met him. It was his, I hope he doesn't mind me telling this. It was his 21st birthday. Mm-hmm. We were playing this club in Culver City, this little bar called the Cinema Bar. And he was living in that neighborhood. So he and his buddies, the band Smooth Pursuit that he mentioned in the interview, they came into this bar. It was at a local bar and we happened to be playing and we were playing a long, long set, man. We were there and they stayed and it was great. You know, we had this lovely night and he introduced himself to me. And I actually said, what's the occasion? Cause all of a sudden, like halfway through the night, like you guys just packed this place. And he says, oh, it's my birthday, 21st birthday. So he goes, oh, wow,
my God, great. This is a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah, we've known each other a while. So, and we talked, you know, he said, well, we have a band. And I said, oh, cool. And then, and he said, yeah, you know, and I play instruments too. So if you ever need anyone to fill in or whatever, you know. And I said, cool. So actually I booked some shows with my band and his band. I said, let's do some gigs together, you know? And so we did. And then that was in January. His birthday's in January. And I remember that April, I remember a guy that I was having, my bass player at the time, couldn't make it to a gig. And you know, it's funny. I think this is kind of maybe a guy mentality, because my wife would always tease me about this. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, Ted can't do the gig. And she's like, oh, why not? And I didn't ask.
Right.
Because all I care about is I need to find a bass player.
Right.
I trust Ted couldn't do it. I don't need to know why.
I totally get that.
My business? So anyway, so I called Brian. I said, Brian, do you play bass? He goes, yeah, I play bass. Okay. I sent him a tape of the songs I had at the time. And here's maybe a few covers we may do. It's only one set. I mean, it's a trio. You know, it's just you, me, and a drummer. So we went and did the gig, and I'll never forget. Someone in the audience called out, and I don't take requests, but someone just kind of just said, do Veronica, the Elvis Costello song, Veronica, which has more changes than like a dressing room. You know, it's like, it's not a three chord one. So we didn't do the song. It wasn't it's not something we normally did anyway. And I said, hey man, you know, that's a great song. And thank you for the compliment. Even thinking we could do it is lovely, but so my man over here on bass, this is his first time playing with us. And I'm not going to throw him. And Brian just looked over at me and kind of whispered, yeah, we can do that. You do it in C? I said, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Veronica. Yeah. In C. Right. And I thought, who is this kid? You know, like that album came out in 88 or so. Like what, how would you know? So the drummer and I, we just shrugged at each other. Like, all right, let's do it. And we did it. And he just nailed it.
That's cool.
And then he mentioned he played piano. So then one night I said, well, yeah, we'll kind of bring your keyboard. And so he sat in on piano. And then one day my guitar player harmony guy couldn't make it. And so he said, I can do that too. And I thought, what's the, and then this got out of hand. Cause one day my drummer couldn't make it. Cause I can do that too.
Oh no. I didn't realize you played.
And there's footage. I think there's footage somewhere maybe on YouTube. This is all happening before iPhones.
Right.
So this is the great thing is these legends can build because there's no proof. Anti-proof.
Yeah. It's a fishtail.
So Brian was really the guy. It, on any given night, we could be a trio, a four piece or a five piece, depending on who's available. Because Brian, and it was like, Brian, we're playing at the Yada Yada on this date. And he said, okay, what am I playing? I said, well, you know, I think right now your keys or
that's
your
really
guitar.
Cool.
Or
so
he was a modular band member.
Yeah.
Which, so no surprise, a guy in Dwight's band at the time saw Brian sitting in with some folks at the cinema bar one night. And said, hey, you know,
excuse me.
Obviously you play a few instruments and you can sing harmony, you know, and you know, I might need a sub for my gig with Dwight Yoakam. And so Brian did that and then he eventually got the gig. And I remember telling Brian, I said, man, first of all, I'm very, very happy for you, of course. And
as Dwight's utility guy.
And I said, and if that guitar spot ever opens up, please just let me know, just you know. And about a year later, he called me and said, I remember I finished jury duty that day and came home and Brian called and says, hey, you know, Dwight wants to talk to you about maybe subbing some gigs, you know. Now here's the funny thing is that the guy that had been playing guitar for Dwight, Eddie Perez of the Mavericks, he left Russell Scott and his Red Hots in 1996.
Oh wow, this is very incestuous. The whole the whole guitar,
it's just happened to be this weird thing of that, you know, he happened to leave a door open. Same guy. Which is really, really funny. So I went and this is going to be I guess I'll frame this story this way if you don't mind.
Do your thing, man.
I think it's a lovely story. A few months before I got the call from Brian about the Dwight gig, I took my daughter, who was, gosh, maybe only 3 or 4 years old at the time. We went down to see a movie, and it was this Muppet movie, this reboot of a Muppet movie with Jason Segel and Amy Adams. And
how many kids do you have?
Just we have one daughter.
And how old is she now?
She's 11 now.
Okay.
Anyway, so in this movie, this guy, this character, Walter, and he lives out in the Midwest, and his whole dream is to be was always to be a Muppet. And he is a Muppet, but he wasn't part of the Muppets. And now at this point, the Muppets are defunct, right? They're just all spread out. And so he goes to Hollywood and he takes the Muppet tour. And it's just a depressing tour. It's just a drag. And he wanders away from the tour because he sees this door with the doorknob's this big lion head, right? And with a tongue sticking out, and you press down on the tongue and that opens the door. It's got cobwebs over it. But he gets curious and he opens this door, and inside it's Kermit's old office.
And this is the Muppet movie.
This is a Muppet movie that came out, about seven years ago.
And this sounds better than most of the movies I've seen on Netflix. I'm actually going to write it.
It's actually a brilliant movie. It's actually beautifully done. But and he finds a contract that says if the Muppets don't do a gig in a certain amount of time, they lose the rights to it. And so that's in the first act, and this is the movie now moves on. Okay. The reason I mention this is that a few months later, I get the call from Brian. Hey, Brian, you know, says they were mixing an album at the time. Says, yeah, come down to the studio and chat with Dwight. Told him about you. Okay, great. So I go down to meet him, and it's it was the old A&M studio is how I always knew it, but Henson has since bought it, so it's referred to now as Henson.
Jim Henson is in the Muppets.
Henson property. Okay. So, I drove over there and I asked for directions to the particular cottage or studio they're in. She goes, yeah, it's that one over here to your left. Okay. So I walk over there and I go to open the door and it's the lion head doorknob.
Oh, wow. That's so cool.
They had filmed it, obviously. And I just took a brief moment and kind of laughed to myself. I said, oh, I get it.
That's really cool.
I'm about to become a Muppet.
That is so cool, man. You must have felt great. Well, that must have been like, that's like the universe patting you on the back and saying, man, this is you.
Oh, I don't really think in that way. I think it was a cosmic joke, at least. That's though. Because my point is, I was really, really yearning for a national level gig at that point. I was juggling a lot of gigs. Wasn't really feeling like any of them were really building into what we would call career. And so that is kind of the moment. It's like, oh, this does feel like, frankly, not, I mean, I hope it doesn't sound crass, but it felt like this could be a break.
Yeah. Why does that sound crass?
I don't know. I guess it's just the reality of it.
Musicians are allowed to be ambitious, I think. They just passed that rule, actually, so you're good.
Oh, good. Excellent.
It's so funny because the amount of humility amongst musicians is like really very high. It's rare that, you made a comment before. I hope before this one, you said, I don't mean to be boastful. And I would have never wasn't boastful in that way.
We're a passive aggressive bunch, though.
Yeah.
So there's certain things to which we feel wildly entitled, and then there's other things about which we just think we're very insecure and think, no, man,
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I could see that. Yeah. But definitely no. I mean, it's great.
Think of it this way. Like, let me put it this way. This is okay. I don't know. In the early 70s, I think it was like the London Globe published this poll, which it was like public speaking was the number one fear. Like it outranked death.
Yeah. I've read that
number. It's been cited over and over.
Yeah.
Seinfeld had a joke that meant that if there's a funeral, more people would rather be in the casket than have to give a eulogy.
Yeah. That's pretty
cool. So I think that probably has some sort of, it's somewhere deep inside of us anthropologically. It's not so much the fear of public speaking. I think it's the fear of standing alone and facing a crowd. going back to the caveman days, those are just bad numbers, right? There's just, those are bad. You wake up out of your cave and you stand up and you look and the whole tribe is facing you and you don't, and like you're looking around and thinking, oh, this is not going to go well. And I think that when we stand up in front of an audience, whether we get, we're reading a book report or we're giving a PowerPoint, I think that most people, just the idea of that is like, oh, we don't, it's like, oh, I know what I'm going to say, but there's still, there's this nervousness. Now, then there's those of us that say, okay, there's a room full of 3,000 people and they're all facing one direction. And it's just us five. Yeah, that sounds right. Mm. That's exactly the geometry that that I want. That's exactly the life I want. That is what, yeah, that sounds good to me. Most people say that's, those are bad numbers. That's insane. You're supposed to have a fear of it. And then we think, no, we're entitled to that, to those numbers. That ratio is just right.
But it's entitlement.
Is that, through, you hear me?
Yeah, but it's entitlement through preparation. It's not entitlement. It's, yeah, it's no, not entitlement, I know, right, through, like, no, you know, I deserve this. You know, I just bought my guitar last week and started playing, so I'm the best in the world. You know, it's like, I haven't met many, no, I've been fortunate. I haven't met almost any guys like that.
No, no, you're right. I mean, look, it makes a difference that you know what you're going to do when you go out there.
Yeah.
You know, I remember first time I'd ever been to Nashville was actually to play the Ryman with Dwight.
Oh, wow.
And which was great, you know, but I had some people who I hadn't seen in a long while. We're really excited about that. They were kind of making a, well, it's a, it is a big deal, by the way. It's a big deal.
Yeah. But,
they were asking me, like, oh, gee, are you nervous? You must be nervous. And I thought, no, we're going in and we're doing Dwight's show.
Yeah, this is what you do. It's like, you know, it doesn't matter where you're playing. It's no different to play there than in the someplace and out.
It can only enrich it.
Yeah.
It can only enrich it.
Right.
And certainly playing the Ryman does. But I just, it never even crossed my mind. I'm nervous. I don't,
good.
You know, like I said, it only makes it better, but it's not going to make you, you know, it didn't really change the thing you're planning on doing. So anyway, I'm sorry. I'm sure I drifted from the original question, but.
No, you were just talking about with Brian, how you got the gig with Dwight.
Yeah, Brian, it was wonderful, man. It was wonderful to be in that group with him. It was, I really owe him, you know, I really, really do.
And how long have you been with Dwight now?
This April, it's been 7 years.
Most interesting experience with him, and what is the most, one of the, you know, top two or three things you've learned?
Oh, wow. Well, the learned thing, every day with him is an education. There's just so much to learn. The nuance of having a career, the importance of discipline, the importance of being thoughtful about what you do. How it's necessary to have humility, a sense of responsibility, being trustworthy. Treating your job like the same way that you want your brain surgeon to treat his job, his or her job. And then there's also the things where he's had firsthand experiences with people like Gene Autry and Minnie Pearl and Johnny Cash. And he can tell you these, his experience and his stories. And it's sort of like, you know, who else is going to tell you stories of screenwriting with Dennis Hopper?
Yeah.
You know, we're firsthand, you know, and he's very, very open. He's just lovely. He's just so open with what he's, or his firsthand stories about Buck Owens alone. And it feels like getting to know a man who's no longer here. Especially because Dwight, usually whenever he tells a Buck story, he always has to use Buck's, he impersonates Buck's voice really well whenever Buck is speaking. So that's always a very, very, a lot of fun. And then obviously being with Dwight, you end up being around people that you just never thought you'd meet. he has his own SiriusXM channel, and he has a show on that channel called the Greater Bakersfield, where he has guests on. And you mentioned some of those guests in your intro. I had no idea I would end up playing my favorite Beck song with Beck in a little room, you know, for broadcast. Like I didn't know that was in the plan, you know? And
was Beck's guitar player there? Or you guys with the band?
No. Dwight has the band. He has, you know, and it's the other great thing is Dwight has always just, he always uses his band.
That's great.
If he's making an album, you know, and so it's an all in.
So it's not studio guys on the record and you're doing the touring.
No. So you really, I mean, you are part of something when you're on Dwight's team. And it's lovely. It's just this fantastic opportunity to play Last Train Clarksville with Michael Nesmith and Mickey Dolan, and to find out that Nez played the lick on the record.
You mean darn darn? That's really cool. Very cool.
And to play that lick in unison with Nez and just sort of like those really, really special things. I have to admit also the K-Earth gig I had for about 6 years also put me in the room with people, Stevie Wonder, Brian Wilson, Sly Stone, man. I mean, we didn't even think he's going to show up, of course. And then he showed up and he was incredible. He was just incredible. Right. And that was just a great kind of, you're just in the room. I remember we shared the kitchen at the studio with Adam Carolla had his show at his FM talk show at the time. And his guests would be milling around. And so then I'd get in a chat during the baseball steroid scandal, got into it with Tommy Lasorda in the kitchen. You know?
That's wild.
Not contentiously. I mean, I was able to pick his brain about it, you know? Talking to Chrissy Hynde about acoustic, about particular Martin acoustic guitars, and these really just kind of how'd I get here conversations.
Yeah,
those are the things. So with all these gigs, you there's always a quirk, and you're going to learn things that you didn't know you were going to learn. And with Dwight, it's also a matter of, like we said earlier, about caring about like the holistic idea of what your career is or who you are presented to the public. And of course, and he's had a career for a long time. He's seen a lot of changes over his decades of being in the business, you know? So, I'm sorry. I know it seems like a very general answer, and I hate platitude answers, but I feel like I've given one.
No, it was very specific. It wasn't general. It was really specific about all the things that you've learned from him. Let's switch back for a minute.
Sure.
Growing up in Yuma,
Assuming
you grew up at all, or aging in Yuma.
Oh, now that you can definitely do.
Aging in Yuma. You said you're a latchkey kid. What kind of work did your folks do? That, and for those people, latchkey kid is like someone who's. Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, that like that's an
80s reference.
Yeah, it's like I was the latchkey kid. It's like you, mom and dad are gone when you come home. So you have a latch key, I guess is like, it should be on the neck, but you're letting yourself in the house and, you know, you're fixing your own thing to eat after school and you're getting your homework done and, or not. And it's on you. And there's a certain level of, forced or non-forced. Independence for sure.
It was wonderful for me because, again, you know, like I knocked the homework out right away and put on MTV. And at the time, mostly people were just lip syncing in their videos, right? Mm. So I'd get my acoustic guitar, sit and wait to watch guitar players. That was my
YouTube tutorial, right?
Especially Mike Campbell, all those Tom Petty videos. The director had the good sense to just get a tight shot of Mike whenever he played a lick or a solo. And so I'd kind of count the dots and where his fingers were and find that note and just work it. I learned quite a few licks just watching those performance videos on MTV or any sort of live music footage, any of those concert videos, like, oh, show the guitar player, please. Had enough of the lead singer. My mom actually stayed at home with me until I started going to school, and mentioned that she worked in the insurance. She worked for an insurance agency. My dad worked at the he's a civilian, but he worked at the Marine Corps
base.
Yeah. Right. And then he went to school, learned how to do refrigeration and air conditioning repair, which
must be huge there.
Smart thing to do in Yuma, Arizona. Yeah. So yeah, that's what they did.
Oh, that's cool. So then he had his own business later in life, or worked for somebody else doing that later.
Yeah, he just kind of like had his own thing going, but the thing about my parents was that they were very, very young when they had me. My mom was 20. My dad was 21. But the reason this matters, the reason I bring it up, is that, you know, as a kid, I grew up in the house of these extremely young people, just generationally young. So they were listening to whatever the new music was. And my dad, I realized later on that I grew up in an FM house, right? My parents didn't listen to AM radio. So right. There's people will mention these massive hits by Barry Manilow or whomever, and I just don't know what's happening.
Yeah, because you listen to FM.
I never heard the Carpenters growing up.
Right. That's funny, man.
My dad had a great rock, a great album collection, and I also, you know, he would have there'd be a Buddy Holly album, and there'd be a Van Morrison album, and then there'd be a brand new album by Mink DeVille. Nobody remembers Mink DeVille. Maybe you do. You're a New Yorker.
I'm old, man.
But I didn't understand that these albums all came from different times or eras, right? Like the Beatle album would get shuffled in with, you know, the
Van Morrison.
Van Morrison album, the later. Yeah. So I was kind of, I grew up in a house where music mattered. You engaged it a lot. And that was very, very helpful to me, that it was a really lovely, lovely, those Friday nights when after dinner and dad would pull out an album and you play it for a while. And then that would think, oh yeah, well, this reminds me of this. You pull out another album and you're just kind of doing this lovely stream of conscious hopscotch and seeing how these things are all related. But
that's amazing. How young your folks were, 20. Well, I don't think mine were much older, to be honest. I think my mom was like 19, so it was pretty
soon. It wasn't that unusual. I mean, still not unusual, depending on time, place, context, culture.
Less common. I think it's less common now overall, probably. People tend training a little have more kids older, I think, now.
Depending on education level.
Yeah, right. You tend to have younger kids at lower demographics, unfortunately. You tend to have younger families.
Correct.
Yeah, lower economics, rather.
So it was just, you know, and my mom was really an advocate of reading, you know, like outside of whatever was going on in school, she would, you know, there's always like this is great. This is called Grapes of Wrath. It's by John Steinbeck. You should read this.
Yeah.
This is called Jonathan Livingston Seagull. You should read this.
Oh, that's great.
Or really hit movies. She's like, oh my God, Lilies of the Field is playing on PBS Friday night. We're watching it. So what's that? Because it's a movie. It's a beautiful film.
So you got really great exposure from her to art and, you know, literature and creativity and movies. That's really great, man.
As much as, you know, two people with a high school education that lived their entire lives in Yuma, Arizona at the time, I look back and think that's very impressive.
Are they still around?
And folks? They somehow. They're still there in Yuma.
How do you get to see them often?
Yeah. A couple of times a year.
That's good.
A couple times a year. They come over for Thanksgiving. We go over there for. We try to avoid summertime.
Oh my God! Yeah, in Yuma.
I don't need 125 degree weather. My wife certainly isn't into that. we see them a few times a year.
That's
my
good.
Sister. My sister lives down here. She lives in Laguna Beach, so it's a little easier for them to kind of come out and see us than it is for everyone to truck over. But
good.
But they're not, it's only a 4.5-hour drive, so it's pretty easy to get there. Mm-hmm.
That's cool, man. It's funny. I when I hear like what you said in the beginning about growing up in Yuma, you didn't have exposure to a lot. I have said this many times. The greatest gift I got was growing up in New York City, because there was nothing that I and, you know, accents, sexual preference,
in color, religion. Yeah. It was there all. It was all normal for me at a very
young age. And it's funny because for whatever reason, I never thought I would live in Los Angeles, much less raise a child here. But right. now that we've done so, I can't imagine raising my kid anywhere else. Yeah. She's such a city mouse. I mean, she loves going out into the country too. My daughter loves going to Yuma because everything's just so much slower there. Mm. There's a lot of space. There's no one's hustling in and out, you know. And she's a very scheduled kid. So that probably has something to do with it. Once we're there, there's no schedule. But the access to museums and even just activities, I mean, she has access to so many things, and she's already eaten so many foods, and they're just all everything's. And she engages the world in a way that I didn't.
Yeah. Cause she's used to all that.
Yeah.
What's funny.
She's like hardly ever on the internet. It has nothing to do with the technology. It has a lot to do with, we just take her out and do things.
Hey man, the fact that she's hardly ever on the internet, be grateful for that. Seriously, man. Yeah. Eugene, what were some of the lower points or the darker periods that you've had to deal with in life, and how'd you get through them?
Oh, I don't really even think, I don't even think of my life as having had a lot of that.
That's great. And if you haven't, God bless you. Man. No, seriously.
I don't want to like contrive some answer to that. You know, I've been very, very fortunate in just about every aspect of life that you could imagine. My health, I had some cancerous tissue in my leg. I don't even say I had cancer. You know, the surgeon went in there, he got rid of it.
Boom.
Boom. In terms of healthy.
Man, that's great.
And anything else probably would involve another person. Again, involve another person.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not my right to tell their story.
Totally get it. Totally
so,
get it.
So no, I honestly, younger when I was very young and on the road, and things just weren't, you know, that was a time when the whole goal was to get a deal, a record deal.
Right, back in the day.
And not having any idea how to get the attention of the bigs, and you're out there in, well, I don't want to name a town because I don't want to denigrate where someone lives, but you're just out in the middle of nowhere. To you, it's the middle of nowhere. And you've got a long drive, and you just, you know, you're barely making ends meet. And it just, there were a lot of those nights. But I remember trying to tell myself, I said, yeah, but someday I'm going to look back and say, well, these were the good old days. You know,
you actually thought that though. You actually said, I know one day I'll be looking back here. How did you have that? That's pretty.
Yeah. We just kind of,
how did you,
I always thought it was like, you know, well, like for instance, like when I did my own album, you know, I did it with a friend of mine produced and other than the drums, I think I pretty much played all the instruments on it as far as I remember. And I remember thinking to myself, like there's no label support. There's no label at the time. We just recorded it. And I just thought, well, if everything goes well, this will be the last time I get to make an album where I'm the only one that has any say.
Right. Right. Okay.
You think of it that way. Now,
glass half full instead of half empty.
Yeah, you had to, you know, because you're betting on yourself at that point. Now, it didn't go gangbusters. It didn't sell well. It never caught fire. And at some point you realize, I don't think this is going to happen. I'm not going to be the guy. But looking back, even that to me was okay because I thought, well, at least I know I tried it. Hmm. So I don't have that regret. And also, it kind of sounds like a joke, but at that time, no one else caught fire doing that style of music anyway.
Yeah.
So I can kind of console myself and say, look, the world wasn't buying those tunes. Like that style, it was just not of that era. And it's easier to just say, the timing was off. It's good. And you can rack it up to that.
Give you credit that you didn't beat yourself up, because you seem to be a guy that is, you obviously have a high bar of standards and a high work ethic, you know, strong work ethic. And, you know, it's great that you were able to not be governed by that. You could say, hey man, I did my best shot, didn't fit. Okay.
Well, also that's pretty mature. You know, and then at that point, you know, at that point, I'm married. She doesn't need a depressed person walking around saying I'm a failure.
Yeah, yeah.
Walking around the house. So that's of no use to any. Like that was no use to her.
Same wife all the time.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. So you've got to,
congratulations on that, by the way.
Oh, thank you. yeah. So there's a point where it's like, well, you know, you got to pick up and move on.
Yeah.
And fortunately I, you know, was able to cobble together a lot of different gigs, along that way. And, which kind of helped if you're busy, that definitely helps.
Oh God. Yeah.
You know, so yeah, it was, you know, did some little voiceover work and the radio thing came along and Sean and I was going on the road with them every now and then. So it was, and then I was, a friend of mine from high school had moved to LA. He's a film composer. And I would work with him.
How was Sean and I, what was that like? Was that fun or is that?
It was tremendous.
Yeah.
It was tremendous. Well, I got it through.
Are those guys really from New York?
Well, they all met, not New Yorkers, but they all met at Columbia University.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that's why they're based out of New York.
Okay.
But they were those guys from Kansas City, from Quincy, Mass.
Okay.
From Boise, Idaho, that, you know, but they were really, really wonderful. They had had this, I guess we would call it like this Forrest Gump existence. I would have said Zelig, but I don't know if anyone's going to get that reference. Because they went on right before Hendrix at Woodstock.
That's amazing.
They played the Fillmore. They were part of that scene. You know, Bob Marley and the Wailers opened for them.
That's
right?
Crazy,
they remember,
isn't it?
Andy Kaufman opened for them. They have great Andy Kaufman stories. They had their own CBS variety show for years. They were the first to put the Ramones. They put the Ramones on TV for the first time.
I do remember that, the variety show. Yeah.
They had just great showbiz stories. And also, it was interesting because now they thought in theatrical terms, which was really helpful to me. They would refer to upstage, downstage. They would say, you know, they would think in terms of blocking because there's so many guys on stage. Like, well, you know, make the stage wider. If this is happening here, you got to move that way to make the stage wider. If it's that guy solo, look in his direction. And they would call it spotlight with your hands or with the neck of your guitar.
Sure.
But direct the audience attention there. These little
– yeah,
those little things, which don't happen in the bars and the clubs, right?
Different perspective.
That's a different perspective, the way they gig. And also that's where I learned, you know, to be at the airport on time, be in the lobby on time. This is how this goes. And which was great. So by the time you get the Dwight call – it was sort of like, well, you know, Dwight averages 110 to 130 dates a year. So it's busier, but those fundamentals are still the same, you know.
They're still touring, Sean and I couldn't believe
it. They still play.
Those guys have got to be like in their early 80s maybe, or is it new guys?
No.
Or?
Well, they have a lot of younger guys in there, but I think there's three original members still there. But remember, they were, you know, college freshmen in 68, 69.
So they just hit really young.
They hit really young, yeah.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. All right, let's talk about gear for a little bit and some music stuff.
All right.
We talked earlier about you playing Tele. What's your go-to guitar right now? What other two guitars would, let's say, round out your top three?
Well, you know, I grew up the first time I even picked an electric guitar, my dad, I was 13, graduating from junior high. He said, "Okay, it's time for you to get an electric guitar." It's great. So we go to this shop and just pick one, you know,
thing.
Which, well, I think he lucked out too because I didn't know any better. I knew I picked a Fender Squire Telecaster.
Okay.
Which saved him a lot of money.
Oh, God, yeah.
By going with the Japanese, which I still have.
Oh, that's nice.
I was drawn to the Telecaster more than any of the other makes out there. And then growing up in Yuma, it was not an accident that to get a gig playing music, I played country music. That was what was going to pay down there. So I got another Telecaster kind of as a backup on that gig. And then as I went into the rockabilly world, I went into a world of archtops, Gretches and Guilds and those things. But then traveling with them can be a little tricky. Changing elevation and temperatures And I'm not a really, I'm not good at fixing my own or working my gear. Sure. So, went back to a Telecaster in the late 90s, actually a guy named Fred Marotta down in San Diego. He has a shop, his line of guitars, he now calls them Naked Guitars, but at the time he didn't even have a company name. He just, he built one from scratch for me. And you see that on my album cover of the, My Favorite Revolution. And there's some videos on my social media of me in my backyard playing it, I think, every now and then. But that's retired. And none of my personal gear is used on the Dwight gig. Everything on the Dwight gig is Dwight's gear.
Okay.
And so he's extremely generous that way. And the number one guitar, therefore, to answer your question, sorry, is the one that I call number one. It's a custom shop reissue of like a 63 Telecaster.
63 or 53?
63.
Okay.
Sunburst, tobacco sunburst, rosewood fretboard. And then we have a duplicate of that that the custom shop made recently for us just as a backup. There's also the Dwight Trash Epiphone Casino that I use every now and then, which is his signature model, which is an Epiphone Casino with a reverse headstock Firebird neck on it.
That's
wild. I really like that guitar. And then the museum piece of the show really is the, he has a Parsons White B-Bender Telecaster that I use. Use it a lot in the studio. We use it during the show. And it's the double wide construction that Clarence White had.
Yeah.
The very first one that Marty Stewart now owns. So that's the main arsenal. And that B-Bender is a real special instrument because, Parsons has only made so many of those of that design.
That's cool. Very cool. So you got a Fender, an Epi, and a Parsons. That's pretty.
Yeah, diverse. That's what I'm using on the Dwight gig.
Pretty diverse.
Yeah.
Is it, what outside of the Dwight gig, is there a guitar you have laying around the house that you just, electric guitar that you always love picking up?
I have a Strat that's really kind of a weird parts Strat that I picked up through a friend that I really, really love. It's a Mongrel Strat. They threw it together at the last second for a photo shoot is the story I heard. So the neck and the body don't match and they're just American original pickups on it. And I just love that guitar. There's also a 68 Gibson 12 string that I have, acoustic.
Yeah.
LG 12 that I really, really adore. It's got a very unique sound to it. Honestly, the new Telecasters, the new stuff that Fender's doing right now, I'm a big fan of, and I have a few of those.
Like the Elite?
American, I have an Elite, which is very, very good, but also just I have an American Original, which has certain vintage points about it, but a few modern touches to it. And American Professional, the American Pro model, is, I think they're nailing it right now with what's great about the old ones, what's great about the new ones. They just add the, and I think the neck profiles just suit me. So as soon as I get them, I'm playing, and there's no adjustment period for me.
That's straight out of the box. That's really cool.
And I'm not changing the pickups. I do nothing to it. I put my 11s on there and I'm just good to go.
Oh, you play with 11s. Are you big? Are you a tall guy?
6'2" maybe.
Oh, that's pretty big.
6'1", 6'1". I don't know.
Yeah. So you have big hands.
I don't know. I think they're average size. I'm a bad judge of that. I started playing 11s early on, just so they wouldn't break or go out of tune as often. And I just thought, this was going back to when I was playing in the clubs in Fasca, and I just thought, okay, just gonna have to man up and learn how to do these full country bands with 11s.
Yeah.
Wow. That's just the gauge I prefer.
Very cool. Any interesting stories behind any of your guitars?
The 68 12 string was a funny one, only because I, this guitar shop in Yuma where I would hang out, it was there for a long time. And every time I go in, I would just hang out all day and chat with the guy, and always grabbed it and played it. And would put it back in the wall. And it was only there for a few hundred dollars. And the guy who owned the shop goes, "You want to buy that?" I was like, no. And then one day I was there and a snowbird came in, right? This strangest guy who came in, and he started asking about the guitar, and played it a little bit, and okay, I showed some serious interest. He goes, okay, maybe I'll come back later. And this, the guy left, and I started just pulling out cash right then and there.
You said, see that? It's a marketing trick. Scarcity.
I said either you had that dude come in here and do that or not, and it kind of doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, and my friend Brett, he says, yeah, it was, you know, this guy who was kind of a struggling songwriter, and his wife sold it to me because the guy had passed away. And Brett, the guy who owns the shop, said, I kind of figured that song's probably got a good song in it though. And then really I ended up writing a bulk of the album that I did, that first album, a bulk of the songs were written on that guitar.
On that guitar.
Maybe the guy was right. You know.
Very cool, man. Best guitar. What's the best guitar and best amp you ever played?
That's difficult. You know, what's funny is I played some, you know, 59 and 60 Les Pauls, that stuff. But unfortunately, there were some of those guitars have never been touched because of the value, which means they're kind of unplayable. Like, you know, just kind of unplayable.
Yeah.
In terms of ease of play, a friend of mine has an early 60s 335 that's pretty, it's just the balance of that thing. Boy, they, you know, sometimes some of these manufacturers just nailed it. That Mad Men, it was a guitar, but that Mad Men episode I did.
Yeah, how did you get in that?
You know, a friend, this girl, this woman, rather, sorry, would open for my band, the Eugene Edwards band at the time. A friend of hers was working on this new show, and they said, we need someone to play an early 60s kind of Bob Dylan style musician, like folk singer. Do you know of any musicians? You know, just have them send me some pictures of some people. And so she thought of me, and that was kind of it. I went and met with the producer with
Wiener. What's his name?
Matthew
Wiener. Yeah.
I mean, I didn't even audition. They just kind of saw my picture and says, yeah, he'll do, you know? And it was fun. We shot right not far from my house. It was a full day there, but I do remember how specific everything was about the clothing they actually had a picture of Dylan in the early 60s in like a shearling coat and the Greek fisherman hat and the wardrobe dude just had that picture and was just picking stuff out of a warehouse and putting it on me. It was like, okay, that's it. That's your look. Oddly enough.
Were you playing electric or acoustic?
No. So it was a mandolin.
Oh, okay.
And so when I got to the set, the guy gives me they'd already recorded the track. So I'm lip syncing.
Did they know it was a mandolin and not a guitar?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But I'm just saying the character plays mandolin. That was just how they had it because it was a version of the song Babylon based on the Don McLean version.
Okay.
So they had already recorded it, the vocals and the musicians already, but just to save money on syncing license, it would cost less just to pay some extras to lip sync to it than to pay the actual people who did the recording.
Right.
So just business. So I get to the prop master, hands me the mandolin. I said, because I need to practice the mandolin part because they're going to do tight shot of my hands playing it. So just to practice, sure. And he says, but just you don't leave my sight. Okay, fine. Yeah, I'm a stranger. They're fine. And I was kind of looking. I was like, wow, you guys even went through the trouble of like of making up a label of like a 1920s era Gibson mandolin. And he's looking at me and says, we didn't make anything. And I realized, wow. Oh, that's a 1927 Gibson mandolin. So please don't leave my sight.
Yeah, that's why I didn't want.
You really didn't have to be the real thing, but it played. I do remember that thing just played beautifully.
Do you normally play that? Like, do you?
No, I'm actually starting to play a lot more now.
Okay.
Especially with Dwight's Sirius XM show that we do. I that's kind of the instrument I play most when we do those. So
that's cool.
Yeah, it's a good thing to pick up.
So you did that. That's awesome, man.
Mm-hmm.
First record you bought, if you remember.
Okay, so I would go to the album shop with my dad a lot, and I was always with him. But the first one where it was like, I get to pick one now, it's my choice, was Kiss Alive.
That's such a, from like guys 10 years younger than me, that's such a popular.
Four. So, and I had older, I didn't have older brothers to turn me on to stuff, but I had older cousins and they were really into that and Cheap Trick and AC/DC. So when I had the agency to buy my own album, I got this, that double live album. That
was Kiss Alive.
Which, you know, the makeup. And by the way, I mean, you know, between you and me.
They had the giant insert with that too, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. I think the picture was of them at Cobo Hall in Detroit, if I remember now. Anyway, but the songs are not very complicated. It's like, it's very, looking back.
Black Diamond. Stuff is,
yeah. So, you know, but for me, it was sort of like, this was just, I thought it was cool. And then fortunately, by the time I was seven, my dad took me to see my first concert, which was Springsteen on the River Tour. And then my taste grew up quickly after that.
Top three desert island discs.
Is it a desert island or deserted island?
Man, you know,
because if it's a desert island, there's cactus, but I'm not necessarily alone.
Well, you know,
and that change.
I'm going to let you make that, you know, pick.
Okay. I think you mean to say a deserted island. I'm alone. I've got no other entertainment or company, right?
That's right. A deserted island. Okay. But I guess, yeah, desert island. Yeah, this is okay. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. Because that changes my answers. Because then if I've got to host parties in the desert.
Right.
Yeah. So
wait a minute. So Craig, who's the most OCD guy you've ever interviewed?
No, is that really bad OCD? I want to give you a thoughtful answer.
Eugene Edwards?
you may want to, well, I'll, again, you know, like you said, awards are good for people. That's the award you're going to get.
There you go.
Also, most annoying guest you've ever had, Eugene Edwards.
No. So it's not even OCD, that's analytical. Most analytical guest. Yeah, that's not really OCD.
That may be it. Yeah. So Kiko by Los Lobos.
Right.
If rock and roll ever had an album that could be called magical realism as rock, it's definitely that one.
K-I-K-O? I don't know that record.
K-I-K-O. It's a mind blower. I'm going to check Born to Run by Springsteen. Mm-hmm. The first Pretenders album. Kind of hard to believe I wouldn't have a Beatles record on me, though. Was it three?
Yeah, but I mean, you could pick a couple more, man.
You know what?
Since you've put so much effort into this question, I certainly don't want to hold you back.
Wait, I haven't, because now I'm thinking I probably want an instructional album on how to build a boat.
Oh, that's a first for sure.
You know, I was just kind of like thinking about it a little further. Might be. By the way, I realize the name of your show is Everybody Loves Guitar.
No, everyone. Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. I missed that up. The name of your show, I think is very interesting, is, since you said I'm analytical.
Go ahead.
It's that I kind of noticed that it's.
It has nothing to do with guitars.
Everyone loves guitar. You didn't call it Everyone Loves Guitarists.
Right.
Thought probably never occurred to you. And it was wise. It's much easier to, because no one's going to argue with the title you went with.
Yeah.
Pardon the preposition.
Everyone loves guitar. Yeah.
Everyone's, because not everyone loves guitarists.
Well, you know, the most common comment I have after I'm interviewed somebody is like, you should change this to everyone loves therapy, because I've had that.
But that's what a conversation should be, right? I mean, at best, I mean, I think it's like why podcasts are so successful, particularly because a lot of them, especially the ones that are just conversations.
Yeah.
I think you can turn on CNN and hear six people talk over each other, but that's just kind of a lot.
That's a lot.
But just to have two people have a conversation, and I think that there's something that we like hearing that. I know I'm drawn to it, you know?
Yeah. Seems to be working so far.
Exactly.
All right. Best decision you ever made? Besides the album, the careful album selection planning.
I'm pretty proud of the boat building album call. Maybe I'm just in the afterglow of that. Well, obviously, you know, certainly getting married was huge.
It's your first, right?
Yeah, first and only. Yeah. You know, having a solid relationship is always a good idea. It stabilizes you. It anchors you. It gives you
If you're lucky enough to have that,
If you're, you inherently in a healthy way, you're in some form in service to another, another person, and not just serving yourself.
Kids is really absurd.
Oh, then that doubles over. Yeah. But, and then the woman I was lucky enough, to marry, is just a very, very supportive and very strong human being.
That's great.
And approaches, has an angle on topics and decisions that I myself wouldn't normally have. So when we talk about it being a balance, it's just, to this day, we've been together for over 20 years, but I still think, oh God, I know I wouldn't have thought of it or approached it that way. That's why I asked you.
This is, I'm assuming she's going to listen to this. This is like huge brownie points.
Yeah. I doubt she'll listen to this, to be honest.
Oh really? Okay. Maybe she will.
Yeah. I mean, she may, but I don't know. I'd be surprised if she
did. Now you're going to, hey, honey, check this out. Because you know you have these nice brownie points coming. It's going to be like, you know, and it's genuine, which is even better.
I think the private ones are the ones that matter most.
Well, that's cool, man. Getting married. Most important things you've learned about yourself throughout your life and your career.
Well, passive aggressive behavior does not help.
Are you passive aggressive?
Oh yeah. I think by nature I am. And then I think any sort of self work or self reflection involves me avoiding being that and simply being more assertive.
I'm assuming then, especially since you're aware of this and as you just said, working on it, that the struggle is taking care of yourself without feeling like you're bringing conflict or opposition to something.
Or just reacting genuinely to a given moment. And you still have to be thoughtful in how you react. Of course, I'm just saying that if you feel a certain way, if somebody has made you feel a certain way, then it's just so much simpler and better and more fair to say, when you said that, it made me feel like this.
Yeah.
And I think passive aggressive people just they're not prone to such an assertive statement.
Yeah.
And that's because it certainly is not going to help you in business. And so much of at least my gig, or if you're doing what I do for a living, the vast majority of it is social skills. And I know many people on your show have probably talked about this. There's the playing level, the amount of scales and notes you can play. There's a max on that if you're going to work for an act. So it's really, again, are you trustworthy? Are you responsible? You know, will you be on time? Can I count on you?
Can you get along with others?
Can I be on a bus with you for 2 weeks and not want to strangle you?
That's the big one. Yeah.
That's the guy who's going to get the gig.
This morning I interviewed a guy named Paul Bialatovic. He's a great guy. Bialatovic. Yeah. And he's Carl Palmer from ELP, his guitar player. He's been with Carl almost 20 years, about 16 years or so. And he said, I've never seen anybody get fired from a gig for lack of technical skills. I mean, you get the gig.
That's right. Yeah. He's exactly right. Yeah. Same here. I've never seen it.
You have any non-musical superpowers?
Well, I don't like anything about myself. You think I actually consider myself as having a superpower?
Oh my God.
I have the ability to calm small jittery squirrels. Not a superpower. How do people normally answer? What answers have you had with that question, Craig?
Loads. I mean,
really?
Anything from, well, I don't ask the same questions every time, but some of them weird and some of them are not weird. Like one of them is like, I'm really good at washing and drying dishes. And that was always an odd one. A lot of guys are really good at cooking. Yeah, right. Superpower.
I cook because I can feed my family, but I cook because I can read. You know, it's like a recipe you do what the thing says and you put the food on the table. It's like superpower. My memory is pretty strong.
I recollect.
It's funny. I did the score for a documentary called Unforgettable, if people can find it out there. And it's about a man named Brad Williams who has hyperthymesia. It's probably maybe 20 people in the world now that discovered have it. And they just, their memory is what we would call superhero level.
Okay.
And so you just say May 3rd, 1972. And he'll say, oh, that was a Tuesday. I was directing a college play at the time. My aunt came in and visited. She had a tuna sandwich. So it's autobiographical. So there's people on the spectrum who can do the calendar. Like you say, March 2nd, 1842, and they'll say Thursday. But they've done a mathematical calculation to do that. But these folks it's the biographical aspect of how they can remember so many things that's very, very unusual. Anyway, so people have commented that, well, you remember everything, and then you meet a guy like Brad and you think, no, this guy remembers everything.
Wow, part of me would want that skill set and part of me would not.
That's interesting. I always think that's very interesting because you get one of two responses, and most people think, I don't think I want that. Then other people think, I would love to have that.
Yeah.
And I think that says something about your life experience. Is going to detail how you answer that. UB Blake, I think, had the quote, "A secret to a long life," and it was good health and a bad memory was his answer.
Well, I heard an interview in time with the Denver Broncos, who John Elway like that, and he said, "What's the secret to being a good quarterback?" Or maybe it was from the Cowboys having a brain fart.
Aikman,
Troy Aikman, I think it was, and he said, "Short memory."
Well, that's funny he'd say that is because, you know, the story is that during one of the – I think it was a playoff game, Aikman took a really bad hit. Aikman completed the series and drive, and then they did the concussion protocol. He had no idea what year it was, but his brain used exactly what it needed to use for the next four plays.
Oh, wow.
So that's a real, what the brain's doing is a fascinating,
it's like allocating resources.
Sure. You know, I've noticed this thing ever since I've been on the road, you get your hotel room, right? And you look at your packet and you're in room 321. I know that I don't have to look at the packet again to get to my room for the next day or so. But the second I check out of that room, I really can't remember the room number. Because there's another room number I'm going to learn that day because we're going to a different hotel.
Sure.
Like, we do that short term. We do these compartmentalized things with our brain.
Oh, wow. Biggest business or personal win?
Ooh. Biggest business or personal win? Boy, I tell you what, this – Dwight's invitation for me to play guitar for him, it's really, really, I really can't imagine my life, what I'd be doing if that didn't happen.
That's cool, man.
And that's just a genuine, it just changed everything. It really did. It really, really changed everything. At a time when I was working, but like I said, you know, I was doing a lot of different gigs and I wasn't really, there was no one focus. I was really, really glad to stop juggling so many things and just to have this one focus as a career. It's really, really hard to underestimate that.
And I would imagine, I know how committed you are, man. I'm sure he really appreciates that. So I'm sure it's, I'm sure it's reciprocal in nature.
He's a very, very gracious and generous guy, you know, and so I do feel appreciated. He makes me feel appreciated on this gig.
Anything you wish you did differently?
Oh yeah. You know, I could have been more assertive, when I was younger and just in terms of career. I could have pushed myself a lot harder in terms of networking or being in a room around more national level acts. But you can make a case that for whatever reason, maybe I just was not ready. Maybe I internally knew I wasn't ready for the big time. Although I was always happy to play for big audiences, and I never shied away from the big moment in any that I can think of. But I just sort of, I wasn't the person to kind of walk in and say, and demand a gig. Yeah. I've really had gigs have always fallen my way. They've approached me and I take them. And I don't know that I've ever really went out and just hunted a thing down. And so you have to wonder in an alternate history, could I have been further along, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Right. Could I have been further along, or could I have been further along just sooner?
Sure.
And then, therefore I would, by now I'd had even more experiences, or I met even more interesting people, or I made more connections. So that occurs to me,
Yeah. Totally get that.
I mean, I don't think about it much, but that you asked.
Yeah, ask a question.
That's
sure, man.
To mind. Yeah.
Two more questions, man. Toughest decision you've had to make, or most difficult thing you've had to do?
I think I'm a pretty fortunate guy in that, and I don't want to give a blasé answer about things. I'm pretty lucky to not have tons of regret in my heart. And maybe that's just coming from really focusing on living a life of gratitude. Like I was saying recently on my podcast, or better, a couple of years ago, maybe actually, when what was that spell in early 2016 when so many of our favorite artists died, Glenn Frey and David Bowie and Prince, and it just seemed like we were losing this unusual amount of our stars and favorites. Yeah, Tom Petty, I remember mostly it was Petty that made me think this way. It was right. it is a shame. It's a shame he's no longer here. But instead of thinking of it that way, let's just be grateful that we got him at all.
Sure.
Let's just be, we got what we needed from Tom. Those records are there. Those memories are there. He really helped provide a soundtrack to a lot of our lives, and we're luckier for it. And to kind of live in some sort of, some sort of category of loss, it's not good. It's of no use to anyone, is it?
I never, ever, ever pay attention to any of that. I don't mean to minimize or disrespect the value of anyone, but it's right. For my own mental capacity. I have no interest in dwelling on anything fucking negative. Call me Pollyanna. Yeah. I don't care. I don't want to think. I have enough negative shit in the daily.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the stuff you have to do. I'm all right.
There's
for me.
Stuff,
you know, right. I don't. I when I see that, I immediately shut down Facebook for a couple of days.
Oh my God.
You know, I don't. Yeah. I haven't watched news in. I'm 55. I haven't watched news in. Very close to probably 35 years.
Well, yeah, I agree. Watching it and reading it are two wildly different experiences. Also, my wife who works in, she works in the corporate world, and one thing I've learned from her years ago, she says, listen, bosses don't like surprises.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a very valuable thing to walk in is like, wow, this has happened. And, should we tell so-and-so? It's like, look, man, bosses don't like surprises. And by the way, your boss probably knows how to handle this thing
right
better than you do, probably done it before and you never thought of it. So let the boss know, because if you don't let him know, then the boss doesn't get a chance to manage this moment. Right.
Sure. Right.
So you're not doing whoever your employer, you're not doing that person a favor by hiding stuff from them. Now, the reason I mention that is, because surprises happen to all of us, right? Thomas Jefferson runs on a non-expansion platform, and then the Louisiana Purchase comes up. It's like, oh, really?
That's a first.
Well, I'm just saying, George.
First reference.
George W. well, George W. Bush ran on a compassionate conservatism thing, but he doesn't. But then 9/11 happens a few months into his run, and he has to now react to that. The rest of his his presidency is a reaction to that. So I'm using these national level historical examples, but yeah, life's going to happen to you as it is. So do you really want to burn calories on the stuff you can't change?
No, it's like trying to figure out why lettuce is priced at whatever the price is, you know?
And I've actually thought about that. When I was a kid growing up in Yuma, Foxy lettuce came out of there, and I didn't understand, why can I not buy Foxy lettuce at my store in Yuma? Where is it going? And then I learned about kind of global trade and all that stuff, and then my head started to hurt. I went and I just took a nap, probably. But yeah,
my head's hurting just going recounting the story.
I'm so sorry.
Last question, man. Oh my god. Okay. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that has been intentional and how much is part of aging?
But you just don't give up, do you?
This is an interview show about you.
I know, but did I tell you I play 11s on my electric guitars? Because I thought would really fit. You didn't ask about a pick gauge. I use a heavy pick when I play electric. I use a medium when I play acoustic. I thought we do 15 minutes on this. It's called Everyone Loves Guitar, Not Guitarists. Personality change. Oh, God. Well, of course, in the past, 10 years, it's hard to think about the 10 years without the Dwight gig and without my daughter, our daughter, I should say. I've become very comfortable with answering questions with the answer of, I don't know.
Oh, that's cool. So you're
I'm very comfortable to the point where it's my favorite response to a question at times. Because if I don't know, I can genuinely tell it I don't know.
So you become okay with not having the burden of having to know everything,
or pretending to.
Good for you.
I don't know, and then that opens you up to listening. So, I mean, I know that's an
answer. It's a great answer,
I think a lot about how that has affected my personality. It was like, I walk in and why are we doing it? Why are they doing it this way? You know? And then, so I was like, hey, excuse me, why are you doing, and it could be something about how someone's setting something up, at a reception. I'm like, that doesn't seem to make sense to me. Why do you guys do it this way? And then they'll have an answer that could possibly blow your mind in terms of efficiency. That might be and also somewhere in that time is really, really addressing passive aggressive behavior. Always being able to be more willing to understand that there's such a wide variety of people and situations, and you can't assume that the way you live or the way you get your information or the way or the options that you have had and will have in your life, you can't assume that everybody else has those exact same options. This helps you look back on maybe the way your parents raised you. And it's not that you're making excuses for people or maybe someone who's wronged you. You're just kind of thinking, oh, okay, well, they didn't have the options that you now have now that you're a parent. Or so many times do I think to myself, well, why don't they just – I'm reading a news story and I'm thinking, well, why didn't they just do this? And thinking, oh my God, my answer assumes that they can afford a smartphone, that there's clean running water where they are. Like, just these things we take for granted. Mm-hmm. And that's also something that as I get older, it helps me kind of dismantle my ego and dismantle my previous world understanding. And hopefully then you kind of rebuild that carburetor of your heart and it just runs a little better, you know?
Thank you. You answer the question. Eugene, listen, man, you're a very sweet guy. You're very sincere, and I really appreciate that, man. Thank you very much. And
as are you. That's what I love about this show. I love that. You know, I think about it's music, and the root of that word is muse, which is to ponder. It's kind of what we're paid to do. It's what we're drawn to doing. And it, I have found that meeting like guitar heroes and like sometimes like, let's not talk about how much of a fan I am of yours. Let's talk about the quirk of this instrument, or there's something like Willie Nelson, you know, like just being, it was like, let's talk about guitar players we both like, because that's going to help normalize this weirdness of Jesus Christ. You're Willie Nelson.
Yeah. Right.
So, and so when musicians get together or speak, things usually, that's what I've learned. If I go out and have lunch with Sadler, who's been on your show, I know there's only so much time we're going to talk about guitars, and stuff is quickly going to get down to the nitty gritty.
Of course,
you know?
Man.
And that's what your show is, and you do it a lot. And
thanks.
What, who are you now as compared to the first episode?
Yeah, I mean me.
I am asking you.
Who am I now?
Compared to the cat that recorded the very first interview.
A nice question. Thank you for asking that, because it's a good answer. I'm a lot more open. I'm a lot more comfortable being vulnerable with my own feelings, mm-hmm. because I've interacted with so many people who are very comfortable doing that, and it's made me much more comfortable. I am so much more aware of how important it is to do what you like for a living.
Another thing where it's a vast minority of people on the planet that do what they love for a living. And so you kind of always think about someone's mood. It's like, why is that guy being such an asshole? It's like, well, first of all,
you
know what I mean? Like he's getting up every morning, just like hating the fact that he woke up and now you not signaling your lane change is probably, it's probably a different annoyance than it is to you who gets to play guitar all day.
Right. Yeah. That's become a tremendous, realization of, you know, I never had that exposure. I didn't grow up in that environment in the business. The little mentoring in business I had was by people who didn't espouse that. They were very money oriented. I'm not money oriented, but I'm accomplishment oriented. And in business, you sometimes measure that accomplishment through money. It sounds like money's the goal, but for me it was more like, okay, let me do as best as I can. In this case, some of it is measured by how much money, how many clients you get, or whatever. But I never, irrespective of that, I've always been real ethical, so I don't really feel, I don't want to, like, I don't really have the need to go down there, because it's not like, well, I did this at someone's expense. I've never done that. I've been working since 14. Yeah. I've never taken a dime I haven't earned, but earned many times over. But I really think it's so important now, and I'm so proud of my younger son. He went back to college, and he's an amazing kid. He had mild cerebral palsy, and he's got, you know, you see it when he walks. He ran track and field 4 years. He swam 4 years.
Really?
And he wrestled 4 years, and he didn't win a match until his senior year. But he decided now, he's inspirational for me. Well, every day when I'm in the gym and I'm struggling with a set, I think of Casey running around the track, dead last sometimes, most of the time.
Yeah. Anyway,
but he's going, and I'm so proud of him. He wants to be a physical therapist, because he feels like, you know, I had physical therapy as a kid and I can help others, because I understand empathetically what that might feel like for them.
That's a great, let me ask you something.
Yeah.
Father to father. Do you remember the first time I guess it would be your firstborn,
right,
when they did something that you yourself cannot do?
Well, he can kick my ass now. I mean, he's, to be honest well, yeah, with you, he's like really, really strong. I wouldn't even think of engaging in a.
It went like,
and I can handle myself. But
you've got to show them.
Crush me, man.
To do absolutely everything from feeding themselves to cleaning themselves to just to where every day is not a suicide mission. You've taught them everything. And then one day they just do something like, I didn't teach you that. How do you know how to do that?
No, I don't. I don't.
And then one day, no, that thought never crossed your mind where it's like,
no, because I always expected them. That was my expectations. So it wasn't like, wow, I'm amazed at that. I shouldn't have. Like, I never had any. I've learned through parenting not to have expectations of anybody, to be very honest with you. I don't mean that.
Well, that's that's a very wise point.
And I don't mean that in a caustic way, like, oh, I don't expect any.
No, I know.
No, I just mean like, man, I don't know who you are and you have the right to be whoever you are. And I have no right at all to expect who you need to be because it's none of my fucking business. But right. I expected my kids to wean off of me, you know, and I was supporting and I'm really happy. So it was not like I don't have a marker per se of it because I was so. Now, when you have one kid, it's a different thing.
Yeah.
It's very different because I had three and I didn't even know, like, it's overwhelming. It's just like from a time management, I didn't have time to notice probably a lot of the things you did.
I'm not
saying, oh, my job was harder. My schedule had more, like, I didn't have time to notice those things probably as much as you did.
There's usually fewer photographs of the youngest kid compared to the oldest kid in most families.
Well, with us, you see, it's not because we have a big break. We have 29, 27, and 19.
Oh, okay.
So well, and two boys. Great. So, you had two boys and a girl. So of course, girl, you know, a million pictures, blah, blah, blah. But, right. You know, so yeah, so I can't answer that question because I don't, okay. If I had one, I'd probably be able to answer that.
Maybe. Yeah.
But I always, it's funny.
It's just one of those things where like my daughter last year became scuba certified and then I just like watch her scuba dive. I'm sitting there thinking, I can't do that. I mean, I technically and literally I cannot do that. And your kid's just off doing something that you yourself cannot do. And it was a moment, you know, just like, wow. I mean, I can, I guess, you know, I could do that, but for right now, that's something that she can do that I cannot do. And there's a sense of pride and there's, sure. And you understand their independence and it's just this beautiful breakaway moment. But also she's a very talented visual artist. She could just draw anything and I can't even make a stick figure. And that's another thing where like that cool. Weird innate talent is like,
but look what you can do with a guitar though. But look what you can do with an instrument.
No, I'm just, there's still things I can drive a car and she can't. I mean, those things are, you know, there's things that are quite codified in that way, but, I can avoid answering questions a lot better than she can. No. Listen, but you're speaking of her, I do.
No, you got to jet, man. Let me just tell people. Thank you, man. I really appreciate it. Yeah. I just want to tell people where to. I wish I could stop saying That's like what I wish. Eugene, I'm going to tell people where they can find a couple of things that you're doing. I want people to get hip to the Jukebox Graduate Podcast. You do that, and you talk about cool things that you can get out of music. It's a positive vibe show. Where can people find that?
Go to the jukeboxgraduate.com.
Okay.
And you'll see episode descriptions. You can get it on iTunes. You could get it. We have a Spotify playlist that's tied to every episode where we pretty much post music that's related to everything we mentioned in a particular episode. It's on SoundCloud, all the usual places. We try to get an episode out once a month. It's a little tough because of our schedules. I have a partner named Dave Rayburn, a friend of mine that we've known for each other since the mid 90s, I suppose. So we've always got to get our schedules together. Sure. And then we like to have guests on. So that's a third schedule. Well, you know about this.
Yeah.
Or you go look at the Jukebox Graduate on Facebook. Please follow us there. I'm really proud of the show. It's a beautiful outlet. It's an interesting thing when you have to listen back.
Oh, I never do that. Are you out of your mind? Oh.
No.
I would never put anything out if I had to listen to myself.
Because we listen back to the what you've recorded so you can edit it. And just, it's been therapeutic to hear myself in conversation.
Okay.
Because we never hear, that's a funny thing where it's like, oh, okay, I interrupt too much, or I say too much, or you pick up little things you wouldn't normally notice about yourself. So that's it's a, but anyway, and we just like talking about tunes, and we try and turn people on to really good music, past or current, because a lot of good stuff out there. So very cool. Yeah, thank you for mentioning it.
And that's another thing. I'm a much better listener than I was 500 episodes ago. Mm-hmm. Okay, so check that out. It's the Jukebox, J-U-K-E-B-O-X, Graduate Podcast. Also, Dwight Yoakam has his own network on Sirius. Is his own show?
No, his own channel.
His own channel on Sirius. That means he's a freaking big deal.
The big beat. Yeah, Dwight Yoakam, the Bakersfield Beat.
The Bakersfield
Beat. Channel.
And the Greater Bakersfield.
Dwight picks. And the Greater Bakersfield is a show that airs every week where Dwight has a guest on, and they chat about their music and they listen to records together and it's exactly what it's like to sit in the front of the bus with Dwight hurling down the highway at 3 a.m.
Dwight and I are going to merge our shows. It's going to be called the Greater Bronx.
There you go, the Greater Bronx. and so the Bronx is called that because it was a family called, was it the Bronx family owned that land? Is that how that?
You are like a walk. Yes, that's correct. You're a walking encyclopedia.
I didn't know if that was the
wait a minute.
Urban legend.
Hold on. Don't be a musician. Let me finish promoting you.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay. Also, Eugene Edwards on Facebook. Check him out on there because he's got all the stuff he's doing on his Facebook page. Also, Instagram and Twitter. It's Eugene Edwards 25, and that's how old the guy looks. So there you go.
Oh, God.
You do, that's, man. Yeah, you know. I was going to almost card you to come on the show. and that's it.
You're way too kind. You're
and that's
way
it. Too kind. Did I miss anything?
No, man, you got everything and more than I wanted, I'm sure. No.
Jukebox graduate, check out Dwight Yoakam's channel on Sirius, the Greater, it's called the Greater, it's called the, what's this channel called?
The Bakersfield Beat
Okay.
Greater Bakersfield is the name of the show that he does within the channel that I think is really, really special. It's really, really special what he's doing there. On that
very
show.
Cool, man. And I hope to meet you one day, man. I hope you come down to Florida. We'll definitely hang out.
Plan on it.
We could go smoke cigars in Ybor City. And
I have not. I used to smoke cigars quite a bit. Now I never really have the time. So that would be a wonderful,
very
wonderful
relaxing.
Experience.
That's why I do it. It's really relaxing. Yeah. You sit there, have coffee or a beverage, whatever you want. And you can tell me about the history of the Bronx and I will acknowledge everything you say.
Oh, God.
Anyway, bro, I know you gotta jump. Thanks for everything. I appreciate you. You're a very sincere guy. Thank you. Everybody, thank you for listening.
It's been a lot to me.
You're welcome, man. My pleasure. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Please check out Eugene Edwards on tour with Dwight Yoakam and check out his podcast, The Jukebox Graduate. And thanks very much to Eugene for spending time with us. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.